This is Apollo Saturn Launch Control. We're now 1 hour, 5 minutes, 55 seconds and counting on the Apollo mission, the flight to land of the first men on the moon. Countdown still progressing satisfactorily. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
Space is patient. It has all the time in the world. Keeping count of that time was strictly man's idea. And so was the idea of traveling in space. The two go together. They've been going together for some time.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Liftoff. Ignition. All right, liftoff, and the clock has started.
The first words from an American astronaut riding piggyback on a rocket. Alan Shepard aboard Freedom 7 headed 302 miles downrange. The date, May 5th, 1961, the clock has indeed started.
This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2 G, cabin at 14 PSI, oxygen is go. Cabin pressure is holding at 5.5. Okay, it's a lot smoother now, a lot smoother. Fuel is go, 4G, 5.5 cabin, oxygen go, all systems are go.
I was in one of the chase planes and Scott Carpenter was in another. It was not a long chase. The entire flight lasted only 15 minutes and 22 seconds from liftoff to splashdown in the Atlantic. But there was time enough for Shepard to look around.
What a beautiful view. Cloud cover over Florida, 3 to 4 tenths near the eastern coast. Obscures up through Hatteras. You can see Okeechobee. Identify Andros Island.
Hal Shepard made our first space flight. But space history, like all history, is a pageant of firsts. The first of our original group of seven astronauts to orbit Earth was John Glenn. As he was erupted into space, his voice shook with the enormity of the power needed to bust loose from the grip of gravity.
Roger, the clock is operating. We're underway.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
0G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful. The sky above is absolutely black, completely black. I can see stars, though, up above. I do not have any of the constellations identified as yet. Over.
Scott Carpenter was up next, up for three orbits of the Earth. Then came that critical period of getting back. Now, all re-entries are a bit hairy, since the heat shield of the capsule is red hot from friction with what we call the sensible atmosphere. And your life depends on getting the drogue parachute out on time. With communications blacked out, Scott's voice was heard only by the onboard tape recorder.
My fuel, I hope, holds out. Getting a few streamers of smoke out behind. There's some green flashes out there. We're getting some pretty good oscillations now. And we're out of fuel. Looks from the sun like it might be about 45 degrees. Oh, it's coming. Like it's really going over. Think I better take a try on the drogue. Drogue out manually at 25. It's holding. Snorkel. Override. Frequency flow rate. On. Standing by for the main chute. At 10, cabin pressure, cabin altimeter, agree on altitude, should be 13,000 now. I see the main is out and reefed, and it looks good to me. The main chute is out.
This is Apollo Saturn Launch Control. We've just passed the 26-minute mark in the count. T-minus 25 minutes, 53 seconds and counting. Still proceeding very satisfactorily.
In June June of 65, Ed White took the longest walk in history and the strangest, from Polynesia to the Caribbean. Something out of an astronomical fairy tale. A man gets out of a pillbox, streaking along 103 miles above the Pacific Ocean. He has a head of glass and a golden tether. He carries an air gun and a camera. He's a satellite of the Earth, as surely as the moon. As he floats through the black hush of space at 17,000 miles per hour, he chats idly with the man who was holding a seat for him in the two-man Gemini 4, Jim McDivitt, variously known as Jimbo.
Okay, I'm separated from the spacecraft.
Okay, you're separated from the spacecraft at this time.
All right. I think I'm dragging a little bit, so I don't want to fire the gun yet. Okay, I'm out.
Okay, he's out.
Am I in your view, Jimbo?
Well, you're not.
Don't sweat it. I'll come over to you. Now, I've come above the spacecraft. I'm under my own control.
When Ed got out, one of his thermal gloves got up and followed him. It was loose and free, floating in orbit as serenely as a star.
Really looks funny out there to see my glove out there, Jim, does it? Yeah. Okay, I'm coming over.
Okay, stand by.
You see me yet?
Huh? Well, there you are. You look beautiful.
Well, the sun strikes Ed White, it's 350 degrees hot, where his body is in shadow, the shadow of deep night, it is 150 degrees below zero. A 500-degree spread. Yet he is comfortable, more than comfortable. He feels great.
I feel like $1 million. This is the greatest experience. It's just tremendous.
It's so tremendous, White doesn't want to come back in. He takes pictures, crawls over and around the spacecraft. Then he becomes the first astronaut to have to be coaxed back aboard.
Let me take a close-up picture there. You smeared up my windshield, you dirty dog. You see how it's all smeared up there? It looks like there's a coating on the outside, and you've rubbed it off.
Gemini 4, Houston, Capcom.
As a matter of fact, you know, that looks like Houston down below us.
Gemini 4, get back in.
Well, this is Jim. Got any message for us?
The flight director says get back in. What?
Okay. We want you to come back in now.
No, back in. Come on. We still got 3.5 more days to go, buddy. Okay.
The traffic peak of the two-man Gemini flights came late in 65, when there were actually four of us zooming through space at the same time. Frank Borman and Jim Lovell aboard Gemini 7 were already in orbit for 11 days when Tom Stafford and I lifted off to join them for our nose-to-nose space rendezvous. As we navigated Gemini 6 to within a foot of them, we could see their bearded faces.
Seven is go. Six is go.
Gemini 6 away, Capcom.
Go.
Okay, we're showing you here on the ground. Can you give me a status?
Yeah, we're in formation with 7. Everything is going here.
Roger. Congratulations. Excellent.
There seems to be a lot of traffic up here, that's all.
It's all a policeman.
This was around Christmas time, and you know what holiday traffic is like. Tom Stafford reported to Houston Capcom that we had spotted an unidentified object traveling in space with us, moving north to south in a polar orbit. Stand by, he said. Let me try to signal him. And we did. That's me on the harmonica. A light moment before retrofire.
This is Apollo Saturn launch control. We passed the 11-minute mark. Now T-minus 10 minutes, 54 seconds on our countdown for Apollo 11. It's a beautiful morning for a launch to the moon. This is Kennedy launch control.
Each manned flight in the Mercury and Gemini series, and there were 16, led step by step to the day when man, for the first time, would dare to break away from the possessiveness of his home planet. The cord was cut on December 21st, 1968, by Borman, Lovell, and Anders in Apollo 8.
Transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth. We've been 31 hours, about 20 minutes into flight. We have about less than 40 hours left to go to the moon.
No other planet in the solar system, not even Jupiter, has a moon as big as ours. And Apollo 8 set out to be its willing captive. There was some anxiety on the ground when, for the first time, that speck of men and machinery disappeared behind the moon. Communication was cut off by billions of tons of rocky mass, which is a surer way of losing your radio signal than going into a tunnel. We waited for word, waited 37 long minutes.
Apollo Control Houston, we've heard nothing yet, but we're standing by.
Then, right on schedule.
We've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in this room. This is Apollo Control Houston, switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell.
Go ahead, Houston, Apollo 8. Very complete. Our orbit is 169.1 by 60.5.
Apollo 8, this is Houston. Roger, 169.1 by 60.5. Good to hear your voice.
For about 20 hours, Apollo 8 circled the moon, scouting its surface with a special eye, or more accurately, six special eyes, for possible landing sites. The world was with them through several live televised geography lessons and a weather report by Jim Lovell.
Houston, what you're seeing is the Western Hemisphere. Looking at the top is the North Pole. In the center, just lower to the center, is South America. I can see Baja, California, and the southwestern part of the United States. And it appears now that the East Coast is cloudy.
However you look at the moon, it's an impressive object. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were no less impressed by their extreme close-up view than the centuries of poets and lovers and astronomers who had peered at its bald face from afar.
This is Apollo 8 coming to you live from the moon. Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and myself have spent the day before Christmas up here doing experiments, taking pictures, and firing our spacecraft engines to maneuver around. Moon is a different thing to each one of us. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding expanse of nothing. And it certainly would not appear to be a very inviting place to live or work.
And one of the amazing features of the surface is the roundness of most of the craters.
Only the very newest features have any sharp definition to them.
The vast loneliness up here on the moon is awe-inspiring. It makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
On Christmas Eve, 1968, the crew, crossing once more the warty, pockmarked landscape of the moon, transmitted along with their television pictures a text big enough to fit their mission, or any other mission in the universe, for that matter.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
To return to the good Earth, their lives depended on the engine called SPS, for Service Propulsion System. If it didn't work properly, they would be lost beyond hope of rescue. All the time they were behind the moon, the world waited to know. Then the voice of Jim Lovell, crackling through the ether from 250,000 miles out.
Houston, Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8. Loud and clear.
Please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
He is the best one to know.
The language of space is terse, full of code words, technical terms, abbreviations like AGS for abort guidance system, computer jargon like double dabble, and scientific names like Doppler-Fizeau effect and Fitzgerald-Lorentz contraction. But it has adopted names, too, like Charlie Brown and Snoopy. That was what the crew of Apollo 10, Tom Stafford, John Young, and Gene Cernan, named their command module and the lunar landing module. On May 22nd, 1969, Snoopy, with Stafford and Cernan, was separated from Charlie Brown to go down and fly above the lunar craters at an altitude no higher than I've flown jets routinely here at home.
Houston, this is Snoopy.
Right, Snoop, go ahead.
He's going. We is down among him, Charlie.
Roger, I hear you weaving your way up the freeway. Can you give me a post-burn report, over?
Yeah, as soon as I get my breath. I tell you, we're down here where we can touch the top of some hills, though.
Roger, great. Sounds great. We copy.
Look at that reel. That's gotta be probably Diamondback right there.
Roger, we copy.
There's enough boulders around here to fill up Galveston Bay.
Oh, Charlie, we just saw Earth rise, and it's got to be magnificent.
When Snoopy had done all his program snooping, there was the unprecedented and complicated and hazardous problem of getting back to Charlie Brown, who was parked, so to speak, in orbit 50 miles above them. The technical dialogue of this maneuver as both vehicles sped around that bleak planet was clearly monitored back on Earth.
Tom, I'll thrust aft. 2 feet per second, I'll stop. I'll start thrusting forward, and you stage fire. Got your master arm on? Okay, that's that way. And then that way, right? Yep, because we're going to be awful light. Okay, you ready?
Something went wrong.
Son of a bitch.
A switch had been overlooked. Snoopy bucked and went into a wild gyrations, wobbling all over the sky. Stafford quickly got control.
Gotta get this damn thing. You get in a gimbal lock?
Snoop, Houston, we show you close to gimbal lock.
Well, I don't know what the hell that was, babe.
Something went wild there on that staging thing. Just took off on us.
Charlie Brown, Houston, they got staging.
They had
a wild gyration, though, but they got it under control.
And I tell you, that was wild, babe, and it wasn't a dap because you weren't AGS. That was AGS.
That was something we've never seen before. We went to AGS, and...
The computer's yours, Tom.
5 minutes to the burn.
Okay, Charlie, we're with you. I think we got all our marbles.
When Snoopy and Charlie Brown rendezvoused above the moon and successfully docked, there was a cheer, like that famous shot at Concorde, heard around the world.
I can see you moving over.
We got him, John. We heard him in here.
Hello, Houston. Snoopy and Charlie Brown are hugging each other.
Sir, roger that. We heard him down here.
Okay, John. That was beautiful. Just beautiful, babe.
Then a routine-sounding dialogue between Earth and Sky that, in a quiet way, summed up man's mastery of the moon shuttle.
Hello, Houston, Apollo 10.
Hello, Apollo 10, this is Houston. How'd the burn go?
Roger, Houston, we are returning to the Earth. Over.
Glad to have you on the way back home, 10.
10 was back home. 11 was now ready to go up and out and on and touch the untouched planet.
Apollo Saturn Launch Control, T-minus 1 minute 35 seconds on the Apollo mission, the flight to land of the first men on the moon. 1 minute 25 seconds and counting.
Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Space is there. The moon and planets are there. The mysteries of creation are there, and suddenly, man is there. He has climbed the steepest of all gradients to reach where no other living thing has gone before. July 16th, 1969, a bright morning. Cape Kennedy falls away in a hurry. Apollo 11, riding atop a superb Roman candle named Saturn, burns into the sky. There are three on the passenger list. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins. Tucked away into their command module, the Columbia, is a lunar module, Eagle. 11 climbs the long, lonely trajectory toward their moving target, which sails around the Earth at the steady, serene speed of 2,300 miles per hour.
This is Apollo Control, Houston. Apollo 11 still passing around the far side of the moon.
A good burn makes a spacecraft happy. And when Apollo 11 swings around to the near side again, Collins has one to report.
Hey, loud and clear, Houston, how are
you? Roger, reading you the same now. Could you repeat your burn status report? We copied the residuals and burn time, and that was about it.
It was like perfect.
The spacecraft is looking good to us on telemetry.
The mightiest command of the space age is just a two-letter word, go. The most dramatic of all goes from Houston is given to Eagle after separation from Columbia.
Columbia, Houston, we're standing by, over.
Houston, Columbia, reading you loud and clear.
Mike, how did it go, over?
Listen, Dave, everything's going just swimmingly. Beautiful.
Great. We're standing by for Eagle. Eagle, Houston, we read you now. You're a go for PDI, over.
Eagle is go for power descent to the moon.
Roger, understand. Stabilization control circuit breakers. And override. Off.
It is Sunday on most of the Earth, a good day for watching and prayer, when Armstrong and Aldrin aboard Eagle start dropping to the lunar surface. So far, every space maneuver of this historic voyage has been tried on our other flights, but not this. This is all new, a landing on the moon.
You're a go to continue power descent. Roger.
Only for a total eclipse of the sun has so many people stopped in their tracks to follow a celestial event. The braking engine keeps firing, straining to neutralize the force of the moon's gravity as Armstrong reads out the dwindling speed of descent and shrinking altitude while looking for a clear landing site.
And Eagle Houston, you're still looking good.
We're now in the approach phase, everything looking good.
Manual attitude control is good.
Roger, copy.
Altitude 4,200.
Houston, you're a go for landing, over.
Roger, understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet. 2,000 feet. 2,000 feet. Into the ag. 47 degrees.
Looking great. Your go.
700 feet. 21 down. 33 degrees. And 400 feet down at 9. Got the shadow out there. Altitude, velocity, light. 100 feet. 3.5 down, 9 forward. How many feet? 75 feet. That's looking good.
60 seconds.
Lights on. Forward. Forward. 40 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust.
Eagle hovers.
30 feet,
just feet
down.
Away from either crashing or realizing the dream of millenniums.
4 forward. 4 forward. Drift into the right a little.
30 seconds.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. ACA at a descent. Auto control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in. Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Collins in the orbiting mothercraft has closely followed the talk down.
We rigged you five by Columbia. He has landed Tranquility Base. Eagle is at Tranquility, over.
Yeah, I heard the whole thing. Fantastic.
Just about everybody on Earth, certainly everyone on the moon, draws a sigh of relief. Armstrong loses no time explaining why the descent may have seemed longer than the predicted nominal flight plan.
Houston, that may have seemed like a very long final phase. The auto-targeting was taking us right into a football field-sized crater. With a large number of big boulders and rocks, and it required us flying manually over the rock field to find a reasonably good area.
Can we copy? It was beautiful from here.
The first question on everybody's mind, how does the moon look?
Now, we'll get to the details of what's around here, but it looks like a collection of just about every variety of shape, angularity, granularity. But every variety of rock you could find. Looks as though they're going to have some interesting colors to them, over.
Tranquility, be advised, there are lots of smiling faces in this room and all over the world, over.
All right, two of them up here.
There was also a smiling face between the moon and Earth. Lonely Mike Collins in Columbia.
And don't forget one in the command module.
Roger.
Armstrong and Aldrin suit up in their bulky life support gear, then slowly depressurize the cabin. It seems like hours before that hatch door is opened to the airless, windless, soundless vacuum of the moon.
Neil, this is Houston. What's your status on hatch opening?
Everything is go here. We're just waiting for the cabin pressure to blow enough pressure to open the hatch.
The events of the next 20 minutes, opening the hatch, climbing out on the porch, and climbing down the ladder, are condensed in what you now hear. But every inch and every second were followed by awestruck millions on a distant Earth lit by the same summer sun.
The hatch is coming open. Okay. Fly call, pump secondary, circuit breaker open. It's open. Verified. How am I doing?
You're doing fine.
Okay, Houston, I'm on the porch.
Roger, Neil.
Okay, can you pull the door open a little more?
Right.
I'm going to pull it now.
Buzz, this is Houston. Radio check and verify TV circuit breaker.
Roger, TV circuit breaker's in.
And we're getting a picture on the TV. Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
Slowly stepping backwards down the ladder, Armstrong lowers himself for the final few feet of a journey that started on another planet.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. I'm going to step off the limb now.
The touch of his left foot on the lunar surface marks the opening, symbolically and in fact, of a new era for mankind. The accompanying words are simple and stark and poetic.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. And with that small step comes an onrush of scientific knowledge, beginning immediately with an answer to a worrisome question. Is the moon's surface firm, spongy, crusty, dusty?
Surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boot. But I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine, sandy particles.
This is Houston. We're copying.
There seems to be no difficulty in moving around, perhaps easier than the simulations of 1/6G that we performed on the ground. Absolutely no trouble to walk around.
Okay, going to get the contingency sample in.
It's very interesting. It's a very soft surface, but here and there where I plug with the contingency sample collector, I run into very hard surface, but it appears to be very cohesive material of the same sort. I'll try to get a rock in here.
Oh, that looks beautiful from here, Neil.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Every tourist visiting a place for the first time is eager to look around as soon as he gets there. But Armstrong's first tour is a tour of inspection. He goes right to work checking the condition of the limb. Once he is satisfied that the eagle's feathers are all in place, Armstrong gives Aldrin the signal to come out.
Okay, ready for me to come out?
Yeah, just stand by a second. I'll move this over the handrail. Okay, you saw what difficulties I was having. Okay, now drop your bliss down. There you go, you're clear.
I want to back up and partially close the hatch, making sure not to lock it on my way out.
Good thought.
That's our home for the next couple hours. We want to take good care of it.
On a leg of the module is a stainless steel plaque to commemorate the landing. It will remain on the moon as long as the moon is there.
Neil is now unveiling the plaque.
We'll read the plaque that's on the front landing gear of this LAM. Dear men from the planet Earth, first set foot upon the moon.
July 1969. It came in peace for all mankind. It has the crew members' signatures and the signature of the President of the United States.
Our moon party explores the immediate surroundings of Tranquility Base, plants scientific devices, and picks up sample rocks. During this, Collins in the command module orbiting above is naturally curious as to how things are going.
Columbia, Columbia, this is Houston and AOS, over.
Yeah, radio line clear, how's it going?
Roger, the EVA is progressing beautifully. I believe they're setting up the flag now.
Great.
They've got the flag up now and you can see the stars and stripes on the lunar disc.
Beautiful, just beautiful.
So far, all Earth-Moon communication has been between ground control at Houston and the two spacecraft, but now it becomes a party line.
Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you, over.
That would be an honor.
Go ahead, Mr. President, this is Houston out.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives, and for people all over the world, I am sure they too join in recognizing what an immense feat this is. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing not only the United States, but man of peace of all nations, and with interest and a curiosity, and with a vision for the future. Honor for us to be able to participate here today.
Man's concept of the heavens has undergone many changes since it was first pictured as a habitat for angels. But on this July Sunday, the surface of the moon is established as a geologist's heaven.
Neil Armstrong has the scoop for the bulk sample collection.
And I'm picking up several pieces of really vesicular rock out here now.
In the foreground, Buzz Aldrin is collecting a core tube sample.
I hope you're watching how hard I have to hit this into the ground to the tune of about 5 inches, Houston.
Roger.
It almost looks wet.
Got it, sample.
Neil, this is Houston. After you've got the core tubes and the solar wind, anything else that you can throw into the box would be acceptable.
Okay, can you quickly stick this in my pocket, Neil, and I'll head on up the ladder.
Got it.
Okay. Adios, amigos.
Hey.
Anything more before I head on up, Ruth?
Head on up the ladder, Buzz.
Okay, I'm heading on in.
Okay. And we got about, I'd say 20 pounds of carefully selected, if not documented, samples.
Houston, Roger, well done.
The men are back aboard, back in what Aldrin has called home, their home on the moon. There is some trouble closing the hatch door, but it finally yields.
I'll move your foot and I'll get the hatch. Okay, the hatch is closed and latched.
Eagle sits quietly for 22 hours on the moon, during which Armstrong and Aldrin throw overboard the spacesuits they used in their walk, backpacks, everything they don't need in order to conserve weight. They break for dinner, stretch out to sleep, doze fitfully, then get up, check and double-check all instruments. And at last, they're ready for the next go, the life-or-death liftoff. The moon is a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to die there.
Eagle, Houston, now you're looking good up.
Got your guidance steering in the egg. Dave, master arm on.
You're cleared for takeoff.
Roger, understand. We're number one on the runway.
Roger.
Now comes the most critical countdown in the entire history of spaceflight. There is no escape tower this time, no chance to abort, no rescue.
8, 7, 6, 5, work stage, engine arm ascent, proceed. Shadow, beautiful. 26, 36 feet per second up. Very smooth. Very quiet ride. There's that one crater on there.
1,000 feet high, 80 feet per second vertical rise.
A little bit of slow wallowing back and forth.
Eagle Houston, you're looking good at 2, ping, zags, and missed in, all agree.
That's 1,170 up, beautiful, 14,000.
I'm going right down US-1.
You're going right down the track, everything's great.
On up to orbiting altitude, where the engine can be shut down, and tracks made for rendezvous and docking with Columbia behind the moon.
700 to go. Okay, I'm going to open up the main shutoff. 350 to go. Stand by on the engine arm. 90, okay, off, 50, shut down.
They've made it. They have now only to link up with the Columbia, crawl back into the command module, jettison the faithful Eagle, only fire the burn that will return Columbia to Earth, only make the classic shuttle run home. Only, did I say? That's the way it is with exploration. Man had only to discover that the world was round, that the oceans were traversable, that he could speak and be heard through the ethers, that he could fly, that he could leave one planet and travel to another. This giant leap could take us anywhere, for man has at last hitched his wagon to a star. And since tranquility has been reached on the surface of the moon, let us hope it will never again seem so astronomically far to peace on Earth.